Hello and welcome to The Rundown, a podcast from Politics Home. I'm your host, Alan Tolhurst, and this week as we come to the end of the year, we're taking a look at Rishi Sunak's progress in turning the Tory ship around, what more he can do as we head into an election year with his party still well adrift of Labour. With me to discuss the PM's fortunes, we have Paul Scully, Conservative MP, and until last month, the Minister for Technology and for London, until he got what he described as the Spanish archer in the reshuffle, the elbow for those at the back. Alongside him is Laura Dunn, political and digital consultant who advises senior Tory MPs, and Ben Riley-Smith, political editor of The Telegraph and author of The Right to Rule, a new book looking at the past 13 years of the Conservatives in power. So, as I said, we're going to look at kind of Sunak's time, obviously his first full year as Prime Minister. Ben, your book looks kind of the longer view, including this, you know, the 13 years that the Tories have been power since 2010. A lot of Tory MPs I speak to say that, you know, part of it is that kind of the tide going out on the Conservatives and that whoever was in charge this last year would have been very difficult to change things around. You know, what's your kind of sense of that? How much has it been the problems down to Sunak and how much of it is down to perhaps some sort of fatigue with the Conservatives being in power overall?
Well, I think it's worth putting in historical context just how impressive in political terms this run has been. So 13 years plus, this Tory run has overtaken the new Labour stretch of Blair and Brown. In fact, in the century before Rishi Sunak took over in the 100 years preceding that, there's only been one longer run, and that's Thatcher Major, at 18 years. So it is pretty rare for a party to be in power that long. But I think with that comes this challenge of how you regenerate, how you project to the country that you can stand for solving the problems of tomorrow. I think the biggest problem, you know, whichever party would have been in power that long, is every single pain the voters are feeling. It's very easy to point the finger at the Tories and say, well, you've had 13 years to try and solve this.
Exactly. The whole arcing back to, well, the last Labour government did X. The longer it goes on, the more that wears thin because people don't have a memory of that, essentially. It's so long ago.
Yeah. And in a funny way, the last election slightly skewed things. It was a big win for the Tories, but it was around this Brexit framing.
Yeah.
So perhaps if it had been a usual election on the usual economy, NHS, the Tories wouldn't quite have done so well. So there is a kind of slight anomaly high point at the previous election. But it seems to me that is the toughest challenge the Tories have going into election year, is the fear that the electorate have just said, look, I think you guys have had your run. Mm. And the fact that the polls have barely moved this year, despite all of the relaunches we've had in the autumn and winter,
suggests that the many resets that we've had and stuff. But so Paul, what are your kind of thoughts on that? You've served under a number of leaders now since you've been in Parliament. And how much do you think that, do you see that kind of fatigue, or how much do you think that perhaps there was an opportunity for Sunak to come in as the new broom and change things, and maybe there's some missed opportunities this year around some of the policies that they've been pursuing?
Yeah, I mean, each of the prime ministers that I've served under have, and I was elected under David Cameron previously, was have been very different. There's been a different feel. That's partly because of the different circumstances around it, but partly because of the character of those people and their administration. But look, a lot of you guys reported when Frank Luntz came to our 1922 committee, and the line that was
covered
was he knows his American politics, he knows his UK politics really, really well. And he said, basically, very provocatively, as he self-admitted, anyone with a majority under 15,000 needs to start looking for a job. And that was what was reported. However, what I took from that was the line that he said afterwards, which you've got one word you've got to get at, try and tackle when you're knocking on doors, and that is enough.
Yeah.
It's exactly as Ben was saying. Are people getting fatigued by the Tory party and throwing everything, on a lot of global pressures, onto the Tory party? So we then come to this year, Rishi's term, where he set his five pledges because he had to try and show that he was stable, but we don't want to go back to strong and stable, we remember that. But it was stable to then be able to put out a message of hope and aspiration for the next 5 years. But people aren't going to be listening to you unless you've done the first bits right.
Yes.
And that's where we're this job undone at the moment, finished.
Yeah. And Laura, so what's your kind of take on that, essentially? As Paul talked about then, that kind of job perhaps not finished that Sunak had hoped, I think, kind of the message of delivery. There was the Windsor framework. There was some early kind of high points, but eventually it's not really transferred into any kind of change in polling terms and in the Conservative Party's numbers. So what's been your kind of take on it so far?
I think it's right to say that the Prime Minister, he is trying, he has made an impact. I think the Windsor framework was a good example at the beginning of the year. I think it was March. And he was right, to take those tough choices on things like net zero and cutting taxes. But I think the whole messaging around, we're the party of change, but we've been in government for 13 years, it's it's not really coherent, is it?
No.
And even I had to sort of sit back and try and mull it over when I heard it first. I think, you know, bringing back the past doesn't really scream change. I mean, I think we can all debate why they brought back Cameron or asked him to serve again. I think it's for the Prime Minister to kind of free up his time so he can focus on domestic issues, but also then tackle the harder end of the party, which we saw flexing its muscles last week, where Cameron can, you know, go back to his sort of natural territory of working with the centre. So I think, you know, the progress has been made, but it's just about connecting all those dots, and that I don't think that they're quite there yet in that coherent messaging.
No, we'll kind of come on to the five pledges in a bit, actually. Laura mentioning Lord Cameron as he is now, you know, Sunak gave in one of his kind of relaunches the party conference speech that we were both there watching, and he, you know, talked about breaking this consensus of politics and being the kind of change candidate. He mentioned change an awful lot, but then he brought back someone who was a big part of that consensus that we'd been talking about, and whether that coherence maybe of that kind of messaging has not really been there.
I think so. You can understand why they did it. So talking to people around the PM at the time, they said, look, the country is desperately tired of all politics and all politicians, and we've been in power for 13 years, and we somehow need... Their strategic analysis with the Keir Starmer had not done enough to kind of grab the ball of change.
Yes.
And somehow Rishi Sunak needed to embody that. He was a relatively new generation Tory, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. He wasn't in the cabinet. He wasn't that well known. So they wanted to try and cast him as the agent of change and taking these big long-term decisions and comparing that with the last 13 years before him. But I think the problem was, it is very hard to do that when people say, well, hang on, the Tories have been in power 13 years. How on earth has it changed to vote for the Tories again? And I do think that narrative didn't especially cut through.
Yeah.
And was totally undercut by the bringing back of one of the four PMs who he was deliberately trying to distance himself from.
Yeah.
So I think maybe there's been an acceptance that it is very hard to cast the Prime Minister as a force for change.
Yeah.
So I don't think you'll be hearing that word that much.
Yeah, Paul, what did you make of the kind of the idea of change and stuff? And do you think that that is the right strategy? I think that in the kind of, I think Danny Finkelstein talks about the three types of campaign you can run, you know, the sort of the steady as she goes, the sort of fear of the other, and the kind of the, but you being the change candidate. Is it right necessarily that the Tories potentially go down that change, or is it kind of more, give us some more time to get going with the things that Sunak wants to get sorted out with the economy and immigration and that sort of stuff?
It's a really tough one because I don't, you know, of course you want to build up a narrative, but it's very difficult in this circumstance to have a binary narrative, that agent of change or David Cameron, because I think when you're looking for stability, actually having someone like David Cameron is no bad thing.
Yeah.
Because if you look at politicians decades gone before, you didn't even get into the cabinet until you were probably in your 60s. You've been around for 20 years. And now we've got some of the 2019ers, talented as they are, in there now. So there's an agent of change, agent for change there. But David Cameron's a reminder that actually just having steady heads is a good thing. But I think, as I say, it was just coming back to the fact that, Rishi had taken over from Liz Truss, and the narrative there had just been broken. And I remember the leadership at the time, what I was looking for when I was looking for a leader is someone who could dial down Liz Truss's extravagances, shall we say.
Yeah.
But put rocket boosters under Rishi.
Yeah, it
was
that
Goldilocks candidate that I was looking for.
Yeah.
And so from having swung to one to another, it's very different, that sort of just instability in itself for people looking in. But that's why Rishi's had to take that time, set those pledges, which everyone thought, that's going to be easy to do at the beginning of the year. I remember the mood music at the beginning of the year from a lot of the media was, well, they're going to sort themselves out, aren't they?
Right.
No, actually.
Yeah, they turned out slightly more stubborn than expected. Laura, kind of on that, the campaigning, obviously we're going to talk a bit later about, obviously we're going into an election year and what kind of campaign, but kind of that change thing, the change candidate idea, what did you kind of make of that, I think, overall? And is that kind of the way that any leader, I suppose, should go into an election, given the backdrop of being in power for so long and the institutional memory that everyone has of the Conservatives over that period?
I mean, I just thought the messaging, it was not coherent for me. I couldn't understand what the party were trying to do, but it just didn't really match up. I think what would have been better was to say, you know, I'm here to get the job done. These are the five pledges. Mm. This is the progress we have made or are making, and this is where we want to be. And that would have been a bit of a more robust narrative. I think, you know, January we'll see a complete, probably a reset, another one. Probably some more speeches setting out what the vision is. But I think, you know, Ben is right in what he says. I don't think we'll be seeing that the word change used in the upcoming campaign.
Yeah, what's going to be a bit tedious if the election ends up Rishi saying I'm not Keir Starmer and Keir Starmer saying I'm not Rishi. Keir's not Tony Blair, and I think that's the other thing about this this point.
Well, I think on the three options you gave earlier, it's the fear of the other that I wonder if they'll really turn up, kind of new Labour, old danger. Because if you look at, you know, endlessly Tory strategists say this isn't 97, and one key reason is that there is not the same adoration of Keir Starmer as there with Blair. And possibly, do we really know what they stand for? I think you're going to get a lot of scrutiny and zooming in on Labour policies, fueled by the Tory campaign.
And the other big difference is the economic circumstances are so different. Blair and Brown took over with the growth in a good place, and therefore they were able to not raise taxes but still have more money for public services. They're kind of hammering home that point already that Labour are going to have to raise taxes if they are going to spend more, and there's kind of that kind of targeting of it. I just want to go back to the five pledges before we move on. I'm not going to ask you to name them. I'm sure we've got them ingrained in our heads.
I wrote them down just in case
I knew you would do. But, you know, what do you make of the idea of having those five pledges in the first place as a kind of concept? Because it makes you kind of a hostage to fortune. And as Paul pointed out, people thought that it was going to be easy, that inflation would take care of itself with the Bank of England in charge of that, and then other things would return and things would change post-pandemic and that kind of stuff. And what do you think kind of make of the concept of having those five pledges? Because essentially you do kind of make a bit of a rod for your own back, don't you?
You do. I mean, I think the concept is good because it focuses minds. It focuses minds on for MPs and for candidates.
Because you're always thinking, how does it relate to these pledges and how getting these done, right?
Yeah, it does. And a bit of discipline, actually. And it is, you know, those are the key things that I think MPs are seeing in their post bag, candidates who are campaigning are hearing when they knock on doors. You know, I think that there was some reporting over the weekend about progress. I mean, halving the inflation is the one that's turned green. That's heading in the right direction. I think, you know, growing the economy, yes, well, the UK is bouncing back stronger than other EU nations. Debt is predicted to fall over the course of the parliament. You know, small boats and cutting the NHS waiting list are tricky.
Yep.
I think we're seeing with the Rwanda strategy, you know, the Albanian one has been a success, but it's about talking and being used as a deterrent, which I think is what, you know, the government wants to do around Rwanda. But the NHS waiting list, that's a tricky one. I mean, I'm thinking about my personal experience. I'm from Wales and, you know, the wait times for treatment here are absolutely horrendous. And I think we're seeing more people now seeking help for problems that they may have put off. So that's why we're seeing that it's a bit stubborn. It's, you know, hard to come down. I think, you know, some of the key issues that MPs are seeing around getting access to appointments with GPs and dentistry. So I think, you know, particularly the new public health minister's got a challenge there to try and get on top of it. But I think, you know, the Prime Minister and the government will try and set out probably, hopefully more coherently in the new year, how they are making progress on these issues and then how that's going to evolve into messaging for the election.
Yeah, Ben, actually, that links to what you were just talking then about the dividing line with Labour. We're already seeing in the last Prime Minister's questions of the year, we saw numerous Conservatives, including the Prime Minister, talk about, well, look at the NHS in Wales, Labour-run Wales, and that's going to be part of that campaign, I think, we see next year.
I think one of the problems with the Tories is whether... So they're trying to draw these dividing lines, but it's actually whether Labour bites and agrees to oppose something they do.
Yeah.
So you keep on seeing, you know, biggest tax cut in an individual fiscal statement since the late 80s in the autumn, although taxes overall are going up to the burden. Labour just said they'd keep them.
Yeah.
So they're trying to draw a tax dividing line, and Labour keeps saying, well, we'll just keep taxes at the level you've set. I think their inheritance tax is the one to watch, because that's possibly one that Labour wouldn't, or if they abolished inheritance tax, Labour possibly couldn't feel they could follow there.
Which we could see. So if there's a spring budget, we could see perhaps that kind of long expected cut in income tax and maybe the inheritance tax finally getting cut to make that, as you say, that dividing line.
And on the dividing line, I think if income tax is cut, Labour is not going to promise to reverse those cuts. That would be my instinct.
Yeah.
But if you are taking 7 billion of wealth taxes totally out of the system, then I think it would be pretty tricky for Keir Starmer to say, yeah, even though I think that's the wrong decision, we're not going to reverse that. So that one, you could see a tax dividing line being created. And clearly on immigration and small boats, they want to use Rwanda. Because on the election, I assume the election will be the second half of the year.
Yeah.
For the main reason, because they're miles behind and you don't call an early election if you're miles behind. But if I squint and try and think of one possible scenario they could call an early election, I wonder if it would be if you suddenly did get Rwanda flights off.
Yes.
And on that day you could come out and say, our Rwanda plan is working.
Labour would get rid of it.
And you frame the entire election on an issue that you do slightly better than the economy or the NHS up against Labour right now.
Paul, what do you kind of want to see the messaging on then? Is it going to be around a big one? You represent an outer London seat. Housing, I suppose, is a massive one. Is that one thing you want to see come to the fore in the new year?
Yeah, really do. I think what we are missing a trick, because we talk about long-term decisions for a brighter future. What we're not doing, though, is taking a long-term decision on trying to give some aspiration to the younger generation.
Yeah.
Even if for not for this next election, for the election afterwards, because you know, it's pretty difficult when any party isn't really speaking to that generation in terms of home ownership and even decent rental prices at the moment in London. So the more they can do to develop that, when you're in, I think it's single figures for young people under 25 voted percentage points voting for Conservatives. We've got to do something about that. You can't just sit there, rely on older people that turn out to vote.
And they've now got children. You know, the median voter is now in the sort of 50s and 60s. They've now got children who are trying to get on the housing ladder as well. And they're seeing the same difficulties that you're just talking about there.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Funnily enough, I have, but that's not what I'm saying. I don't want to mind in Australia.
I would also add to that as well. You know, I think the party needs to lean into attracting, as you said, younger voters, but also women, actually talking about the good stuff that is being done for those groups. So, for example, like the changes to childcare, you know, raising the number of women who are in work, that's increasing. And, you know, I think where they're going to see an impact is where people see changes in their pockets, you know, how it affects their daily lives. And that's going to be crucial to the success of those five pledges. And if we add any more.
And that's why we shouldn't lose track of what we have done, that work on childcare, the work on, you know, getting more people into work, more disabled people into work, more women into work. And tackling some of the sector's vacancy rates and these kind of things. There's a lot that has been done, but you're looking at these big global pressures around the economy, inflation, energy prices, etc. We've had three one-in-a-century events that we've had to tackle over the 13 years, whether it's the end of the global financial meltdown, COVID, and indeed the war in Ukraine, coupled with political instability and the rise of social media. That provides a real challenging backdrop for any party. We've seen that in across the world. It's not just Conservatives as a centre-right party falling out of favour towards the left. You've seen it in the opposite direction in other countries. It's incumbency, actually, that's the challenge at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. But so the Rwanda plan that Ben mentioned there, obviously we saw kind of a rebellion of sorts last week in that kind of second reading. And we know that kind of party management is a bit of an issue. We're seeing he did initially bring MPs together because, as you say, they wanted to see the kind of end to the chaos that we saw under Liz Truss. How well do you think Sunak has done in terms of that party management, and how well is he going to have to do to kind of nurse this bill through Parliament in the new year with all the difficulties of, you know, the One Nation group on one side, the, I hate to call them the five families on the other side, but the right, Paul's pulling a face, the MPs on the other side of the party. You know, how difficult is that going to be? And has he got the skills of party management?
Well, I think it's the people around him have also got to make sure they're stepping up in the new year.
Yeah.
So that the whole of the number 10 machinery is working with the whole of the parliamentary party. Because you talked about the five families. It sounds very mafia style. Anyone knows their godfather, I think the five families have got to go to the mattresses. they've really got to take stock at sea for the fight ahead, rather than actually just arguing amongst themselves, you know what they are doing. That it's there was a sense of brinkmanship in that second reading, because if they are trying to strengthen that bill too far, it's not going to get through the House of Lords. Even if Rwanda stayed on board as a country, you're not going to get through the House of Lords. So you don't have a policy anyway. If you weaken it, you don't have a sufficient deterrent. So really, it is one of those things that's sort of on point at the moment. You can't do a lot with it. And I think the various strands of the party, shall I say, rather than the five families, keep talking about the five families, need to recognise that politics is the art of the possible.
Yeah, yeah. And but on that note, do you think that Sunak is doing, and the number 10 machinery is doing enough to reach out to those different groups to say, look, it needs, you mentioned Goldilocks earlier, it's going to have to be in that kind of Goldilocks zone, you know, where it's tough enough that it works, but not too tough that it falls foul of various commitments. Is there enough going on in that sort of outreach?
I don't know is the honest answer, because it's a balance between the leadership of Rishi and Number 10 and the tension and problems within the parliamentary party in terms of the fact that once you start rebelling, it's easier to rebel a second time.
Yes.
We've seen that over the last few
years.
It becomes
a habit, right?
When we've seen people in the various administrations who have rebelled in the previous administration. It's actually reminding ourselves why we're here.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, people out there, out the window that I'm looking at the moment, are busy cooking eggs, doing other stuff. It's actually how to speak to them in their language about the things that they care about rather than what we're obsessing about in Parliament.
Yeah.
Can I put the case for the defence, Rishi Sunak and party management? Because I actually think he's done pretty well. So if you cast yourself to where we were last autumn, the party just killed off a second leader in 4 months. It was in open revolt. Rishi Sunak was rushed into position. I think actually over the last year plus, he's done pretty well, you know, on party management. He got the Northern Ireland protocol bill.
Yeah, much smaller rebellion on the Windsor framework than we were taught.
So you got the deal with Brussels, and then you know, a load of people, Brexiteers, went over the top, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, trying to quash it. They got defeated. He then managed to steer the biggest parliamentary threat internally, Boris Johnson, out of the party. Now, it was the Privileges Committee that did that, really. But the one person who would have jumped at the chance of becoming Prime Minister again on the backbenches is now out of the Commons. Mm. He's only had one defeat in the entire premiership, which is on the contaminated blood scandal, which is a very important issue, but wasn't one of those crunch critical moments for the leadership. And then if you actually look at how the voting on the Miranda bill played out, despite all that noise and briefings from the right, zero Tory MPs voted against it.
Yeah.
And yes, there was a big chunk of abstentions, 30-odd. But given how much uproar the party was in, I think actually is in a relatively safe place.
Yeah.
And again, if you look at no confidence letters that people endlessly talk about, who knows what the real number is?
Because I had Graham Brady on the podcast last week, and he knows the real number.
He's the one man, he does. but there is only one Tory MP publicly saying they've put in a no confidence letter.
Yeah.
And in the past, when Boris fell, I think it got up to in the 20s before they triggered that 50, vote. So I think, you know, clearly there have been lots of problems, there have been lots of by-elections triggered by scandals. But given the challenge of controlling the parliamentary party, I think actually he's done pretty well on that in the last year.
Okay, well, Laura, then kind of bringing on to what's going to happen next year. We talked about that maybe there's going to be another relaunch, another reset. We've mentioned various issues on the economy and migration, perhaps NHS, housing. Where do you kind of see that campaign going? Because obviously, regardless whether the election is in May or October, we're going to see all next year really the start of that campaign. And what do you kind of think that the shape of that's going to be? How is Sunak going to try and sort of do that next relaunch and push things into that election campaign?
I think that they would be wise to show the progress that has been made and actually focus on the positive and how that's making a difference to people.
Because we'll talk about another five pledges, right? Another new set of five pledges and that sort
of
stuff.
I hope not.
We'll have to remember another set of five pledges. We'll have to write them on both hands next time. Yeah.
We will. I think, you know, with the Rwanda stuff, that's expected to be back in the House 2 days, Committee of the Whole House, the second week of January. So as Paula and Ben has said, that's going to be very interesting to watch. And I think actually the place to watch that will be in the Lords, because the votes probably are not there, and they like to cause a bit of mischief, don't they? Our elder states people.
These days. They're quite young. They're younger than us
some of them. I know. So I think that would be interesting. But I think in terms of the party messaging, I think lots of MPs will have to ask themselves, if they want to win, how are they going to behave? So does that mean that they are going to kind of fall back in line? Is CCHQ going to be coming out with that big stick and hitting people? So I think, currently, there's a lot of individuals who are actually not thinking of the election, but they're thinking of themselves and what their position might be come, you know, if the Conservatives, you know, do win re-election again, or if we're looking at Conservatives going into the opposition. But I think, you know, the messaging will be around the economy. I think looking at tax cuts. And I think the NHS actually and access to services. And again, you know, I reference being from Wales. I think we have seen those attack lines being used in PMQs and by different ministers. And I think that's probably going to form a central part of the campaign. But also Starmer's record. I think we've seen reports recently, haven't we, about both sides sort of digging in, looking at stuff that they can find to use.
Yeah, we've had some very old comments of Starmer being dug out at PMQs and that sort of stuff, haven't we? Yeah.
I do think it's going to be a dirty campaign. I think it's going to be one that we probably haven't seen like the likes of this before.
Yeah.
Probably taking some tricks from the American style of campaigning, that playbook.
Yeah, I think so. Paul, on that kind of the stuff with Labour, how well do you think Sunak's done, I suppose, we're going to see him obviously as a campaigner, both neither him nor Starmer have run national campaigns before when they go into this election. How have you kind of felt his performance measuring up against Starmer? Because that's going to be the thing that, no matter what the campaigns are about, that's what people are going to look at when they think of where they're going to put the tick in the box, you know, Sunak versus Starmer. How have you kind of read that between the two of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's highlighted well the fact that Keir Starmer has sort of been all things to all men. He's changed a lot of his own pledges and promises over the years since his leadership, his own leadership campaign. I suppose he's been busy defending his own position, the Prime Minister's been own position, that hasn't yet got out to the wider electorate, because they won't be noticing that until they're getting closer to the election. That just tends to be what happens. So I think then there does need to be that blue water. You talked a little bit about inheritance tax before. I would hope that that actually we'd be looking at tax thresholds or something like that.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
would
that affect fiscal more drag people. Really affecting people.
I talked about aspiration, but inheritance tax, I think the wider base that we're trying to look at now with red wall, blue wall, it's sort of wider than just looking at one inheritance tax that only a few percentage points of people actually pay.
Yeah.
Tax threshold has been, the fiscal drag
has been
going on for a while. So that's what's going to put money back in people's pockets. And it ultimately, the reason that the pledges were where they were, there were five pledges, they were all in order, a particular order, three of them the economy, one was the NHS, one was immigration. They're the three issues, along with housing, that people are talking about. That's what we've got to reflect in the next stage.
Mm. So before we kind of go on to kind of the final question, I suppose, as a campaigner, we've kind of seen Sunak get a little bit tetchy, I think, with reporters and that sort of stuff. And maybe there's a fear that as a campaigner that he hasn't been tested on a national campaign. And how do you think he's going to fare? And that kind of tetchiness that we've seen in various press conferences, that's going to be us lobby hacks are going to keep probing and pushing away at that and kind of pushing him on those kind of things.
Well, he denied he was tetchy in a recent
he did deny he was tetchy, but he
admitted I do get frustrated sometimes. Well, it's an interesting question. He has run one one-on-one campaign last summer and he lost.
Yes.
Now, maybe that was on policy rather than his personal performance. I do think he is very message disciplined, which is important in a campaign.
Very much so.
Possibly more so than Keir Starmer. So we'll see how that aspect plays out. I think if you were trying to construct a scenario where the Tories do much better in the election than you think they would, one huge advantage that we know of is they have a campaign structure that has won elections well recently.
When you get the electoral machine whirring, it's got a history of success. Yeah. And some of those people from 2019 are back again now.
Exactly. So Isaac Levido was the campaign manager in 2019 when they very cleverly framed the entire election around Brexit. It was a slightly more subtle message than people think. So it was get Brexit done. Yes, that appeared to Brexiteers, but they were also deliberately trying to appeal to Remainers who, 3 years on, said, look, the country have decided, can we not just keep relitigating this and let's move on? So that was quite cleverly framed. So, you know, they have a campaign machine that understands how to frame the debate on certain things that maximise their vote. Labour haven't won an election since 2005. So whether they have the campaign structure and the rigour, and often oppositions don't. I mean, the 2010 Tory campaign, if you talk to people involved in that campaign, as I did for this book, you know, they admitted that it wasn't the smoothest campaign.
Yep.
And ultimately, they didn't get the majority.
Yeah,
they performed into coalition less than
expected. Yeah. So, Laura, then just finally from you, then what's the kind of one big thing you think that Sunak needs to do in 2024 if we're to sort of turn this around? And the big problem I think was that when he took over, he had his polling was much higher than where the party was, and the kind of hope that he would drag the party up towards him, and instead he's kind of gone down to where the party is now. How does he push that up? What's the one thing you want to see in 2024 from him?
I think you're talking to colleagues and MPs, the one thing they said to me is authenticity. Mm. So I think, you know, the Prime Minister can't be everything to all people. Nobody can. So I think he needs to find his voice and use that, which I think that he will. I think, you know, we're going to see the campaign structure change. So Ben just said about Isaac Lewido. I believe he's going to be in CCHQ full time from the new year. I think we'll see the Prime Minister out and about more. I think town halls actually are a format that I think he does actually perform well in, but yeah. It's about how he uses those to get the authentic voice across, the difference that he's making and the vision that he has for the future.
Yeah. And Paul, then last word to you then. What do you kind of want to see? As I said, you've got a seat in outer London. It's perhaps one of those sort of bellwether seats. And what do you want to do to keep hold of that seat and for the party to keep hold of lots of seats like yours up and down the country? What do you think he needs to do in 2024?
Yeah, Sutton's a really interesting place because it is quite bellwether. If you look at it's a microcosm of the country. If you go to the north of the borough, it's quite heavily white fan man. And people sort of, when talking about Brexit, they were 2-1 out. They were talking about how to control immigration, about sovereignty, these kind of things. And you go to the south, it's sort of slightly bigger houses, a bit more leafy. The people that commute into the city talking about financial services and passporting during Brexit and those kind of things. And so it tends to vote in that way that the country does as well. And you have to, you know, what I've tried to do over those, the last few years is to, you know, work on my stronger base in the south and then develop the people in the north, as has happened in the country. But again, explain what I'm doing. And even if you don't like what I'm doing, hopefully you appreciate why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
It's human first, politician second. So it's exactly as I was saying about authenticity. And you don't need Rishi to do everything. I know these things tend to be more presidential these days.
Yeah.
Actually, it's the whole cabinet. You need people like Vicky Atkins to get out there and some of the new guys in the cabinet to really show that they understand as well as have solutions.
Paul, what's your majority? Are you under the 15,000 threshold?
I'm well under that, mate. I'm 8,500.
I would say, yeah. I would agree. I think, you know, there's a cabinet that's got so many talents there, but also in the ministerial ranks, you know, you've got great people like Joe Churchill doing great work.
Yeah.
I think it's important that that the government and the PM and the party, you know, really utilises all those talents and those different voices.
And the experience as well. And the experience as well, because that's the advantage that we've got over Labour. We've got some real talent there, but we've got some experience that actually are doing the job day to day that can then actually reflect what we should be doing. People like Joe, you're absolutely right. Whereas actually in opposition, it's really difficult because you can try and land punches, but you haven't got all the facts and figures in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, Labour have got maybe, what, two members of Shadow Cabinet who've got experience of being a Secretary of State, and it's not necessarily a period they want to necessarily hark back to either. So yeah, you could highlight that, I suppose, in that campaign.
No, absolutely. I think that's right. I mean, on opposition, therefore, you can actually promise things that you don't necessarily, you know, you might afterwards say, oh yeah, we didn't understand the figures or something at the time. But nonetheless, I think, you know, tomorrow, for example, we've got the Horizon Post Office scandal coming back to Parliament. And I was the minister that started the compensation scheme that set up the inquiry there. And it's, again, that was a very much, it's the best thing I'm ever going to do in politics, frankly. But that was human first, politician second, because I'm sitting there in the middle of the civil servants saying, how on earth are we not doing anything about it? And if you can draw on those kind of experiences, then other things that we've done over the 13 years, then I think it starts to reconnect us with the public.
That's all we've got time for this week, but you can read all the latest on the big stories from Westminster in the run-up to Christmas at politicshome.com. And keep right up to date by subscribing to our 7-day a week newsletters by clicking on the link on our homepage. Thanks again to my brilliant guests, Paul Scully, Laura Dunn, and Ben Riley-Smith. Thanks all for listening. Please subscribe with your podcast and leave us a review. If you want to get in touch, then reach out to us on Twitter at politicshome or email us via news@politicshome.com. Next week, we'll be doing our annual review of the year, looking at the maddest political moments of 2023. So watch out for that in your podcast feed in between Christmas and New Year. But for now, I've been Alan Tolhurst, and this has been The Rundown.